values and concentrate power for himself. Barack Obama and Donald Trump, a study in contrasts. The charismatic crowd leader, the campaign of Barack Obama. When Barack Obama ran for president in 2008, he was the ultimate crowd leader. His iconic chant was, "Yes, we can." He called for his supporters to look to one another, not just to him. "We are the ones we've been waiting for. We are the change that we seek." While Hillary Clinton told stories of her own agency, that she was ready on day one, Obama was talking about building a movement and scaling up the community organizing skills he once used to help the disenfranchised on the south side of Chicago. His was a highly participatory campaign. In fact, it was a stunningly ambitious and successful use of new power tools and tactics. The digital hub of it all was mybarackobama.com, MyBo, a sophisticated, for its time, platform to help people organize, volunteer, and raise money. These online efforts helped mobilize record numbers of volunteers under the motto, "Respect, Empower, Include." The campaign got to such scale because it gave volunteer leaders real responsibility and incentives to recruit and develop their own local teams. This explosion of new power energy helped the relatively unknown Obama eclipse the old power donor apparatus of the Clinton campaign in the closely fought 2008 Democratic primaries, raise hundreds of millions in small donations, and win resoundingly in the general election. For all Obama's talk of "we," however, his campaign still relied heavily on the magnetism, charisma, and symbolism of Obama himself. Shepard Fairey's iconic hope poster wasn't of a crowd of people, it was of Barack Obama. He was the hope. Yet he managed to then use that energy to create a genuine grassroots movement and to champion values that made others feel powerful. Obama ran a campaign that was at once highly participatory and highly structured. Everyone had a lane in which to participate. As an Obama volunteer, you had some room for creativity and agency, but you also had a clear brief and accountability, which were summed up in the epic 280-page organizing manual the campaign developed. As the legendary field organizer, Zach Exley, described it after visiting Obama's field offices in Ohio in 2008, other recent attempts have failed because they were either so top-down and or poorly managed that they choked volunteer leadership and enthusiasm, or because they were so dogmatically fixated on pure peer-to-peer or bottom-up organizing that they rejected basic management accountability and planning. The architects and builders of the Obama field campaign, on the other hand, have undogmatically mixed timeless traditions and discipline of good organizing with new technologies of decentralization and self-organization. Think of this as an exercise in blending power, an art we will describe in Chapter 10. All that structured participation worked superbly in an election setting, when goals and an endpoint were clear and feedback loops, doors knocked on, voters called, funds raised were closed. Across the nation, people like volunteer Jennifer Robinson, whom Zach Exley described in his account of the Obama campaign, found the experience transformative. "I'm a different person than I was 6 weeks ago. I've realized that these things I've been doing as a volunteer organizer, well, I'm really good at them. I have a passion for this. I want to continue to find ways to actively make this place, my community, a better place. There's so much more than a regular job in this, and once you've had this, it's hard to go back to a regular job." But, as we shall see, after the election, this highly structured and directed approach to involving people became more straitjacket than supercharger. From rent-a-crowd to intensity machine, the campaign of Donald Trump. Wow, whoa, that is some group of people, thousands. This is beyond anybody's expectations. There's been no crowd like this. Donald Trump began his presidential campaign by buying himself a crowd. He reportedly hired a casting agency and paid actors $50 each to show up with homemade signs and cheer him on as he descended the elevator at Trump Tower. He started that speech by noting with surprise just how many people were in attendance and then offered a rambling tour d'horizon of the epic failings of America and his unique capacity to put things right. China was beating America. So was Japan. So was Mexico. The situation in the Middle East was a disaster. Obamacare was a disaster. Obama was a disaster. I beat China all the time. Nobody builds walls better than me. I've done an amazing job. I don't have to brag. I don't have to. We need somebody that literally will take this country and make it great again. Many rolled their eyes, dismissing him as they would their mad uncle muttering obscenities at the television. Others took notice. The brazen self-confidence, a clear list of enemies, and the money-back guarantee of a better life all hitting their mark. As we know now, this renter crowd would grow into a real one, capable of destroying the established political wisdom, embarrassing the pollsters and pundits who had promised Trump had no hope, and vaulting him into office. While both Trump's campaign and Obama's in 2008 showed a mastery of how to work up a crowd, there was one crucial difference. Obama's approach to participation was highly structured and crafted, where Trump's was unstructured to the point of anarchy. There was no reliance on a carefully organized field army. It was the difference between a weighty organizing manual and a 140-character tweet. Whether this was strategic genius on Trump's part, or just disorganization, or a little of both, this gave Trump's supporters the freedom they needed to make his message their own. Trump caught fire in no small part because of his intuitive grasp of how to build a movement in a new power world. As we touched on in the introduction, Twitter turned him into the leader of a vast, decentralized social media army that took its cues from him, and in turn fed Trump new narratives, conspiracy theories, and lines of attack. It would become a deeply symbiotic relationship. On the night of Trump's election victory, the bulletin boards of 4chan, a Reddit-like social network that attracts mainly young men and which prides itself on extreme views and provocations, lit up. The white supremacists, who had championed Trump's candidacy, couldn't believe their luck. As Abby Olheiser recounted in the Washington Post, "I'm effing trembling out of excitement, bras," one 4chaner wrote Tuesday night, adding a very excited Pepe the Frog drawing. "We actually elected a meme as president. Pepe the Frog is the green, human-like frog developed by Matt Fury for his comic book series more than a decade ago. The 4chaners appropriated the once-innocent Pepe into the symbol of the alt-right movement, and soon added a mop of orange hair to his image so that Pepe would embody Trump himself. During the campaign, rather than distance himself from these meme-making extremists, as the typical politician would do, Trump empowered them. He signaled repeatedly to his most extreme supporters to keep at it, and indeed, to go harder. He retweeted white supremacists, who spread even more overt versions of his own, barely, more camouflaged race messaging. In one instance, he retweeted from a now-deleted account, @cheesedbrit, whose avatar was a neo-Nazi symbol, the false and racially provocative claim that 81% of white murder victims are killed by blacks. The real number, according to FBI statistics, is around 15%. When challenged, Trump refused to apologize and simply said he couldn't check all the facts he retweeted. The message was clear. "I'm not going to try to rein in my supporters." He went further. His unambiguous message to his crowd was that he'd have their back no matter what they did. He notoriously offered to pay the legal fees of a white supporter who punched a black protester at a campaign event during the primaries. He told his crowd, "If you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously, okay? Just knock the hell. I promise you, I will pay for the legal fees. I promise, I promise." The secret to Trump's success was not simply his own unrivaled ability to grab the attention of both social and mainstream media. His message also moved and morphed without him via a vast network of people who took it and made it their own, a classic ace effort. These were groups that had been activated in recent years by causes like the Tea Party, the gun rights movement, and the nascent alt-right. Trump took that existing energy, dialed it up to fever pitch, and transformed his campaign into what we call an intensity machine. Throughout the campaign, Trump had significantly higher levels of social media engagement and sideways content creation from his supporters than his opponent Hillary Clinton. In national opinion polls, his supporters were about 10 points more enthusiastic about him than Clinton's supporters were about her, even as his favorability ratings overall trailed Clinton's by about 10 points. Positive sentiment about Trump on social media also outstripped Clinton's by 10 points in the critical final 5 weeks of the election, according to the 4C Insights. It tells us something interesting about the role of new power in the 2016 election that social media analytics firms like 4C, Spreadfast, and Social Bakers proved better at predicting the strength of Trump's support than traditional pollsters. 4C was the same firm that correctly predicted the Brexit vote. Conventional wisdom among elites, and even betting markets, predicted a Remain vote with 90% odds on the day of the vote, similar to the odds they assigned to a Clinton victory just hours before her defeat. Strikingly, according to these social media analysts, the moment during the campaign that expanded Trump's social media following the most was his campaign's supposed nadir, the release of the Access Hollywood tape, in which he boasted about pussy grabbing. This moment, with much of the country lined up against him, caused his supporters to rally around him like at no other time in the race. Donald Trump, the platform strongman. Following Trump's election, George Orwell's 1984 saw a surge of sales. The tale of a totalitarian dystopia overshadowed by the all-powerful figure of Big Brother rode a Trump bump back to the top of the bestseller list. Yet the comparison between Big Brother and Trump is not quite right. While Big Brother wielded his power through mass conformity and a fierce resistance to individualism, Trump became stronger by supercharging individual agency, taking the reins off and championing unorthodox, previously socially unacceptable behaviours. His drug of choice is not one that subdues the populace, but one that excites it. And he thinks about media differently too. While the telly screens in 1984 serve as ways to standardize and contain citizens' actions, Trump's platforms, especially Twitter, serve to individualize and liberate. He seeks control of the conventional media and the establishment not by co-opting it, but by undermining it, seeing it overrun by a battery of constant attacks from his crowd. He has no need for a ministry of truth to ensure that one state-sponsored opinion is held by all. In fact, he revels in the instability of countless truths. The more the merrier. Trump is an example of what we call the platform strongman, a leader who co-opts a digital crowd and deploys new power in order to advance largely authoritarian values. He rallied a highly empowered, anarchic, digitally savvy movement of people, while he paradoxically championed a more orderly and severe rather than more free and open America. His campaign speeches painted a jarring picture of a chaotic and violent country, magnifying and vivifying threats from outside and in, and presented himself as the only man strong enough to take that threat away. Trump also promised to restore the natural order. By implication, that new order would re-elevate Trump's most intense supporters, less educated white men, at a time when many felt they were losing status. And it's in the context of these authoritarian values that all of Trump's chest-thumping, self-aggrandizing, and aggressive behavior might have appealed so strongly to some Americans, and so viscerally repulsed others. His promise to restore law and order, a coded attack on people of color at a time of historically low crime rates, and his focus on enforcing the rules of the immigration system all had a powerful draw. As early as January 2016, researchers had identified the one weird trait that predicts whether you're a Trump supporter. And it wasn't your gender, age, or religion. It was whether you had an authoritarian value set. Pollster and researcher Matthew McWilliams found that Trump was the only candidate in either the Democratic field or the 16-person Republican field whose support among authoritarians was statistically significant. McWilliams hypothesized, nearly 10 months before Trump's unexpected victory, that, in a general election, Trump's strongman rhetoric will surely appeal to some of the 39% of independents in my poll who identify as authoritarians and the 17% of self-identified Democrats who are strong authoritarians. The platform strongman is a particular species of the co-opter archetype in our leadership compass, and it is where we see such a big difference between Trump's campaign and Obama's. This combination of an old power authoritarian value set and a sideways, unstructured new power model lies behind some of the most potent and dangerous leadership models in the world today. This is precisely the combination that ISIS deploys. It offers a return to order and certainty, namely a brutal medieval order, but spreads that message with savvy, decentralized control. Slipping from crowd leader to cheerleader. Obama in office. If you want to know how I'll govern, candidate Obama promised, just look at our campaign. President Obama took office with the promise that the more than 14 million Americans like Jennifer Robinson, who had contributed in some way to his victory, might now enter government with him. Exley had laid down the marker before the election. Obama must continue to feed and lead the organization they have built, either as president or in opposition. But that was not quite how it panned out, as we've noted. Obama campaigned as a crowd leader, but he governed as a cheerleader. While the rhetorical torch for new power stayed lit, he failed to build a genuine movement to help him govern, to help elect his successor, or to create a sustained and local grassroots to help his political party win up and down the ticket. Obama left office with some major legislative accomplishments and relatively high approval ratings. He had governed for 8 years with no major scandal, and his original supporters still had a strong emotional connection to him. But his political opposition had won back the presidency, controlled both houses of Congress, and dominated politics at the state level. The missed opportunity for Obama was that he had no real transition plan for his crowd. All the energy and commitment that people felt had nowhere to go next. As Rolling Stone's Tim Dickinson has reported, in the critical 2 months after Obama's election victory, Obama's much-vaunted campaign largely went dark, a decision the political technology observer Micha Sifri called criminal political negligence. The administration then made the fateful decision to fold its organizing infrastructure, renamed Organizing for America, OFA, and its more than 13 million members into the Democratic National Committee, becoming part of the official party machine. This decision put real distance between Obama and his crowd, and limited its capacity to act to support his agenda. For example, it could not put pressure on those Democrats who were on the fence about key parts of the president's agenda, like his health care law. It also alienated the many political independents, Republicans, and far-left types who had connected with Obama but had no interest in being part of the formal political infrastructure of the Democratic Party. Obama, a new president facing a big economic crisis, was intensely focused on enacting his policy agenda and, perhaps awed by all the tools of state now at his disposal, slipped into old power mode. He tried to mobilize his supporter base around major moments in the making of his healthcare law, and with some success, but it had already moved out of a movement mindset, and it showed. OFA asked supporters to make generic pledges on various issues, such as support for a public option in the healthcare bill, which Obama quickly dropped. But it was too cautious, and had not tended to the community carefully enough to be able to whip up any real passion. Of course, as the Obama crowd was suffering from neglect, another well-funded popular movement was emerging to oppose it, the Tea Party, which mobilized mass protests and angry town halls to oppose healthcare reform, presaging its huge victory in the 2010 midterm elections, which crushed Obama's governing majority. Obama's supporters wanted to do more than pledge. Had Obama invested heavily in enabling his supporters to launch local efforts, giving them freedom about how to organize in support of him, he might have built a strong, locally grounded progressive movement. This could have been a powerful counterforce to the rise of the Tea Party, especially outside of the major cities where Democratic support tends to cluster. Obama's team eventually seemed to view his crowd more like an ATM machine than a movement. When the time came to run again in 2012, big data had replaced movement energy as the most sacred ingredient in the Obama tactical repertoire. The heroes of the re-election campaign were no longer the volunteer organizers, though he still had a good number of those. They were the backroom data whizzes. Clickbaity emails flooded our inboxes with subject lines like, "Dinner? giving the recipient a momentary flutter of hope that the president was finally asking if we wanted to hang out. But Obama was also suddenly the kind of friend who always seemed to need to borrow money. The change he was waiting for often came in $5 increments. Obama achieved a great deal without a hugely energized governing movement. He showed a respect for the office of the presidency and its conventions that his successor in large part has not. But once President Trump was elected and had the ability to sweep much of his legacy away, one was left wondering what might have been had Obama the president acted more like a genuine crowd leader and less like a cheerleader. Signal, structure, and shape. The three key new power leadership capabilities. Today's leaders must succeed in a world not just of institutions, but of crowds. As we've seen, leading and staying in the crowd leader quadrant is a complex task. It is one that demands a particular set of skills, and an unlikely new power leader, Pope Francis, can teach us a lot about what is required. Pope Francis's first act as the Bishop of Rome was to pray. At the moment he was elected, in fact, he was already praying, overcome by what he has described as a great sense of inner peace, one he says he has felt ever since. But his next three acts were, each in its own way, remarkable. He sent back the fancy red cape with the ermine collar that newly elected popes typically wear, electing to don simple white robes instead. He reportedly told the Vatican Master of Ceremonies, "You put it on instead. Carnival time is over." He then broke with protocol as he greeted his cardinals, refusing the elevated throne, saying simply, "I'll stay down here." Finally, as he was revealed to the world on the balcony of St. Peter's, he did not ask for a blessing from his cardinals, nor did he ask for the success of his church. Neither did he, as was the tradition, offer his first papal blessing to the people. Instead, he asked his people to pray so that God may bless me through you. It is hard to think of a role that is richer in symbolism than the papacy. And in his first hours as Pope, Francis sent strong and resonant signals about how he was thinking about power, as much by what he did not do as by what he did. Gone was the superhero cape. Out went the throne that raised him above his flock. That evening he abandoned the papal limousine and took the minibus with his cardinals to supper. On his first night as Pope, he slept in the guest house apartments, leaving the papal penthouse palace empty, a living arrangement that became permanent. A Latin American cardinal with a track record of unconventionality, Francis had not expected to become Pope. He had other plans afoot, with a place lined up in a retirement home for priests in Buenos Aires. The bookies didn't think much of his chances either, staking him as a rank outsider at 33-1 in the pre-conclave betting markets. So he had arrived in Rome anticipating a quick trip with just a small suitcase. The church he now headed was badly damaged. Corruption was rife, especially around the Vatican Bank, and the church's sins weren't just financial. Revelations of decades of child abuse throughout the church that had harmed thousands of its most vulnerable charges deeply damaged its reputation and had a direct impact on church attendance. Catholics' opinions of Pope Benedict had been relatively low and were falling in the later years of his reign. Beyond these deep challenges, there was a general sense that the church was fading from relevance. Too few young men were joining the clergy in the United States. Many parishes were short of priests. In Rome, inefficiencies and inertia within the Vatican organization were all too clear. This had been a long-standing issue. The famous joke among Vatican insiders is that when Pope John XXIII was asked how many people work at the Vatican, he answered, "About half." The church also found itself on the wrong side of major cultural shifts, such as the growing acceptance of LGBT people. It was often drawn into public debates for what it stood against, abortion, contraception, women clergy, rather than what it stood for. On top of all this, Catholics had been rattled by the odd and almost unprecedented resignation of Benedict XVI. The church Francis inherited was, as long-standing Pope Watcher BBC correspondent David Willey described to us, in a terrible crisis. In the story of how Francis has approached these big challenges, we can start to pick out the skills unique to leadership in a new power world. Signalling is the way a new power leader makes a crowd feel more powerful through his speech, gestures, or actions. Obama's rhetoric of "We are the ones we have been waiting for" was classic signalling, designed to stoke his supporters' sense of agency and willingness to participate. The Pope's request for, rather than bestowal of, prayers worked in the same way. Structuring is how a new power leader puts in place structures and practices that enable the participation and agency she seeks to build. This is typically much harder work than signalling. Obama's 2008 campaign created a wide range of ways people could engage and not just feel ownership, but actually take it. A variant of this is unstructuring, creating the broad space and energy for people to engage on their terms, but without any prescription or limitations. Donald Trump, as we have seen, intuitively grasps this. Shaping is how a new power leader sets the overall norms and direction of her crowd, especially in ways that go beyond her formal authority. When a leader is successful, these norms become so well understood that they are adopted and upheld by the crowd itself, and no longer rely on the leader. The ultimate aspiration of the octogenarian Pope Francis, as we will see, is to shift the norms of his church in ways that last well beyond his tenure. Signalling. How Francis acts as walking parable. Within a very short time, the Pope has become the world's most popular leader, with high favorability ratings across all faiths. He is even well regarded by atheists. Much of this enthusiasm has been driven by his mastery of signalling, which he did so disarmingly at the time of his elevation to mark himself out as a different kind of pope, and the use of which has come to define his tenure. More than most previous popes, Francis has been encountered through a series of highly public and highly charged symbolic gestures, each of which affirm his values. Think of the time he traded use of the papal Mercedes-Benz for a well-loved Ford Focus, or when he lingered in St. Peter's Square to bless and embrace a severely disfigured man, or when he washed the feet of refugees. All these signals send a very clear message to his cardinals and his congregation as to how they ought to carry themselves in relationship to those less powerful. In this sense, he has become a walking parable, as Father Thomas Rees, senior analyst at the National Catholic Reporter, described it to us. The images and moments he generates have become modern icons, representations of the divine in the tradition of those once daubed on the cells of monks or hung in the vestries of churches, but now going viral on Instagram. Structuring for participation. Beyond his symbolic actions, Francis's tenure has been defined by an assertive reform effort, overhauling the structure of the Vatican Bank, bringing greater transparency into the Vatican administration as a whole, and placing reformers into key positions. On one level, this can be seen as a necessary reaction to corruption and calcification within the Church, but it also speaks to his belief that the Church should act as an inverted pyramid, with the clergy ministering to the people, not living on clouds above them. To realize this inversion, Francis has sought to push power away from Rome and toward local leaders and their communities. Take the 2015 Synod on the Family. A synod is typically a gathering of bishops behind closed doors to discuss changes in doctrine and approach. This time, though, Francis mandated that questionnaires first be distributed throughout the Catholic world with the goal of engaging families themselves, listening to their joys and their hopes, their sorrows and their anguish. "To my knowledge," said Dr. Thomas Groom, a professor of theology at Boston College, "it's the first time in the history of the magisterium that they have genuinely attempted to consult the laity." Another initiative that pushed power down, this time away from the cardinals and toward local bishops and priests, was the groundbreaking and headline-making Amoris Laetitia, a papal exhortation on love in the family, where Francis suggested that local bishops and priests might make their own judgments on how to treat divorced and civilly remarried Catholics, including potentially allowing them to receive communion, something that the Church had always forbidden. By empowering parishioners, priests and bishops, Francis is structuring for participation, creating ways for them to lead their own local efforts. Shaping. The quality and strategy of mercy. Who am I to judge? These are the most famous five words of Francis's papacy, spoken in reply to journalists on a flight back from Brazil as he discussed the Church's position on homosexuality. These words and their canonical implications have been parsed in great detail. But looking for practical takeaways may be missing the point. It is through such statements that Francis sets direction for the Church without actually creating new doctrine. Note that this has been a criticism of him too. Shaping the norms of his flock is a subtler task than the traditional exercise of authority. As mentioned, the Pope has worked hard to steer his Church away from the hot-button issues that have tended to divide and define it. He has been outspoken in attacking the clergy's obsession with a disjointed multitude of doctrines to be imposed insistently. Francis wants his Church to expend its energy and capture the public's imagination through its core work of serving the poor and becoming a home for all. His remarks on refugees in the early weeks of President Trump's administration point clearly in this direction. It's hypocrisy to call yourself a Christian and chase away a refugee or someone seeking help, someone who is hungry or thirsty, toss out someone who is in need of my help. He has done this too through an emphasis on mercy, perhaps his defining theme. His words, "Who am I to judge?" don't change the Church's letter of the law on homosexuality, but they do effect a real shift in focus. He is attempting to transport his Church away from an old power paradigm, defined by clergy handing down judgments on their people, chastising their behaviours, dividing them into saints and sinners, the included and the excluded. He is gradually shaping a Church that focuses less on inward debates about rules and more on outward demonstrations of its core values. As he has noted, mercy is doctrine. By shaping new norms and by enlisting the Church's millions of followers and not just its few leaders in doing so, the rules themselves may follow. Yet the deep moral challenges posed by the Church's child sex abuse scandals aren't going away, and Francis is not confronting them with the same zeal he has brought to other issues. Take the case of Australia's Cardinal George Pell, handpicked by Francis to lead financial and other reform efforts in the Vatican, even as he was being roundly criticised for his lax handling of child sex abuse cases over several decades. In 2017, Pell himself was charged by Australian authorities with child abuse offences and was finally forced to take leave. If the Pope does not confront all forms of corruption at the heart of his Church, and instead seems to put protection of his favoured clergy above respect for the laity, as his predecessors have too often done, then his efforts to bring new power to the Church will ring hollow. The biggest tests for Francis may be yet to come. Three sketches of new power leaders. Francis aside, leaders aren't very popular these days. The 2017 Edelman Trust Barometer shows that only 37% of people think of CEOs as credible. And trust in all four institutions tracked, business, government, NGOs and media, to do what is right is in decline. The first time Edelman has observed this since they began measuring trust. A range of factors, the rise of new power forces among them, has left a generation of leaders relying on behaviours and ideas that suddenly feel out of date, in many cases after serving them well for decades. And this is not a problem that can be solved with a simple emotional pivot. The conventional wisdom that encourages our masters of the universe to shapeshift into masters of empathy, aligning themselves with the twin moons of humility and authenticity, does not go far enough. In fact, it can distract leaders from the more difficult task of moving the focus away from them and onto their communities, a skill mastered by the following three leaders. How to be a genius in the new power world. The wisdom of Ai-Jen Poo. When Ai-Jen Poo won the MacArthur Genius Fellowship, she went well beyond the default line of acceptance. "I couldn't have done this without my colleagues. This is their award too." She and her team at the National Domestic Workers Alliance, NDWA, invested her $625,000 MacArthur grant, intended to facilitate Pooh's own creative growth, into the growth of the alliance's workers instead. Thus was born the Dorothy Lee Bolden Fellowship, which would create leadership development opportunities for the group's vast community of nannies, housekeepers, and caregivers. Bolden was a key early figure in advocacy for domestic workers. She founded the National Domestic Workers Union in 1968, paving the way for Pooh and her colleagues, who founded the National Domestic Workers Alliance, which gives voice to 2.5 million domestic care workers in the United States. Pooh's use of the MacArthur stipend sent a potent message. This is about us. By honoring a woman who came before her and marking her faith in the future of the community she serves, she positioned her prize as the validation of a movement. This moment was a testament to Pooh's character. When you meet her, it's clear she's doing this work for all the right reasons. But it was also a strategic imperative. Pooh's effectiveness as a leader relies on striking the right balance between her prominence and her crowd, a group of marginalized, mainly immigrant and black women who are among society's least powerful. As she put it, her job is to use her power in a way that creates power for more people. This is a special challenge in her case, because a severe imbalance in power is something her constituency experiences every day. They really understand inequality because they live in poverty, and then they go to work in the most extreme forms of wealth. Beyond the wage and wealth gap domestic workers experience viscerally, they sometimes tell horrific stories too, of neglect, abuse, and threats. For Pooh, as a leader, managing this tension has not always been easy. When she was in her 20s, there were fierce debates as to whether she, who had never been a domestic worker, could legitimately represent the interests of domestic workers and lead their movement. Ironically, the better she did in galvanizing what had previously been a set of disparate groups and a largely neglected community, the more she found herself portrayed as someone who lacked the street cred to lead. She has managed this tension and held her ground with an understated and collaborative style, taking care that others are seen to take on important assignments and ensuring that her governing structure includes those she serves. The majority of her board members, whom she refers to as her boss, aren't policy experts or donors, as they are at most nonprofits. They are domestic workers. She estimates their average annual income at $22,000. Every 2 years, Pooh brings together the NDWA community to elect the board and set the alliance's course. 500 domestic workers come together for debates on their organization's key issues and challenges, from salaries to strategies. Proceedings are interpreted in 8 languages so that everyone can take part. Those who want to run for the board get the chance to step up and address the assembly. It is a tense scene. Each candidate gets 3 minutes to speak. Some thrive, others fumble. All get cheered on. There's a candidate debate over the key questions and challenges facing the workforce. Then everyone gets to vote. Pooh thinks of this process as one of the most meaningful aspects of her work at NDWA. As she told us, everyone was on the edge of their seats because they owned the organization, you know? She has structured the NDWA to make domestic workers protagonists, not mere beneficiaries. As she puts it, the whole organization is basically set up as a platform to give voice to that constituency of people who are completely isolated. She thinks of everyone in her world as an organizer. And these are not just words. NDWA's Strategy, Organizing and Leadership Initiative was developed to train leaders who, in turn, work to develop the leadership and political skills of domestic workers. That initiative has strengthened the capacity of groups across the network, with an estimated 3,000 workers learning to build movements and advocate for their rights. Pooh's unique position demands that she be extra conscious of issues around status and signal in a way that shows she is truly investing in her crowd. To lead her crowd effectively, she has to constantly demonstrate how she can blend into it. From Neutron Jack to Electron Beth, a new style of leader at GE. From time to time, Beth Comstock will present one of her colleagues with an interactive egg minder. This novel device uses Wi-Fi to connect you with the eggs in your fridge, so never again could you be at the supermarket and find yourself unaware of how many eggs you had left or how old they were. It's the kind of device that delights technophiles, but most others find faintly ridiculous. The product was an epic flop. Handing out those surplus egg minders lets Comstock, GE's vice chair, say something about the culture of innovation at GE. The egg minder was part of GE's partnership with Quirky, a much-hyped new power startup that allowed the crowd to invent their own products. Comstock herself had championed the Quirky relationship and had been closely tied to it when the company stumbled and then filed for bankruptcy. The signal she is trying to send, therefore, is clear. I failed at this, and I'm still here. It's not just okay to engage the crowd and fail spectacularly at GE. It is expected and embraced. Consider how different a philosophy this is from that of the legendary GE leader, Jack Welch, who made his reputation through elimination of error and failure with his Six Sigma management process and through elimination of staff with ruthless and regular culls. It was the layoffs that earned him the nickname Neutron Jack, because he'd explode and empty a building of people while leaving the structure standing. Comstock leads very differently. In GE nickname terms, we could think of her as Electron Beth, defined not by how she blows things up, but by how she binds people together. Her success in leading GE into the digital age has earned her promotion up the ranks and caused her to be named one of the 100 most powerful women in the world. At the heart of her success is how she has structured GE to deliver greater creativity inside and out. She targeted not just the 300,000 people on GE's payroll, but the vast communities beyond its walls whose involvement she sees as key to her company's future. The Quirky story was part of an effort led by Comstock around open innovation, the same approach to crowd-based problem-solving tried out by NASA. She chalked up early wins like the Engine Bracket Challenge, where GE partnered with GrabCAD, a digital platform of more than 1 million designers and engineers, to dream up a lighter, more efficient part for its planes. The winner was a young Indonesian engineer with no aviation experience whose idea delivered an 84% improvement. She built on these successes through partnerships with organizations like Local Motors, the first of its kind new power car company we'll profile in the next chapter, to crowdsource product development challenges to engineers, coders, and scientists both online and in microfactories across the United States. Within GE, Comstock called on Eric Ries, author of the popular book The Lean Startup, to consult on a new way to encourage and speed up the company's internal innovation and product design efforts and quickly incorporate early customer feedback. This led to the creation of the FastWorks program, which has now trained over 40,000 of GE's leaders. FastWorks is leading a shift toward experimentation and prototyping, nudging norms at a company whose stock price has been in long-term decline, and that some say has become too big to innovate. It has also led to some big wins, as well as, we can safely assume, a couple of new egg minders. A project to create a digital wind farm delivered a solution in less than 4 months and delivered a 20% increase in renewable energy for each wind farm. GE has estimated that FastWorks will save several million dollars per project in product development costs. Comstock is trying to push power down to distribute the decision-making process as widely across the network as possible, in effect to empower individual cells to relay signals and respond to their local conditions as they see fit, as she puts it. This has meant redistributing people to staff up local markets around the world, as well as attempting to shift cultural practices like feedback. In place of the annual performance review, experienced in most organizations like a dreaded annual dental checkup, GE now uses mobile tools that allow many more people to offer insights and highlight issues in real time. We'll discuss the importance of feedback in the New Power Workplace in Chapter 11. Peter Sims, the entrepreneur and writer, has known Comstock for years and has seen her up close as she has risen in the ranks. He describes how she flows freely among communities of artists, makers, and robotics wizards, rather than just spending her time with the suits. As Sims puts it, while she has a very big job and a very big title, nobody who interacts with her experiences that. By sourcing new ideas from unexpected places, Comstock is blurring the line between the crowd and the corporation. How Lady Gaga unleashed her monsters. Die-hard Barry Manilow fans are known as Fanilos. You know who you are. Justin Bieber has his Beliebers. Demi Lovato, Lovatics. Ed Sheeran, Cheerios, really. But Lady Gaga's fanbase has embraced a different kind of identity. They are known as Little Monsters. The name had emerged early on in Gaga's relationship with her fans. But after she saw the movie, The Social Network, about the rise of Facebook, she set out to create her own social network to bring her closer to her fans and her fans closer to one another. Her vision was of much more than a Lady Gaga fan page. She wanted the site and its branding to be not primarily about her work, but about fostering her fans' confidence and artistry. The result, LittleMonsters.com, allowed her legions to share their comments, art, ideas, and stories with one another, as well as to organize events. She quickly had 1 million participants. For Gaga, this was a mission that mattered. Many of her fans were girls confronting brutal body image expectations and sexism, and LGBTQ youth grappling with questions of identity and difference. The big payoff for connecting her fans was that it gave her a tool to promote values they could embody well beyond their interest in her. Monster at House of Fannies put it like this: "Our bond is beyond just loving the same star. Our bond is based on the philosophy we share. We all believe in the importance of love, compassion, and tolerance." Hector, a 17-year-old Colombian teenager, defines a little monster as someone who doesn't judge or criticize what others are, regardless of their sexuality or skin color or other traits and stuff. It should perhaps be no surprise that Gaga, who often experiments with her own identity, has chosen to encourage her community's confidence in their own. As Professor Amber L. Davison writes, "Rather than Gaga pushing her fans to adopt a specific identity, the narrative of the little monster is about embracing their own identity. In reclaiming the word monster, they have turned difference and marginalization into strength. The little monster's community offers a textbook example of optimal distinctiveness. Monsters feel just the right amount of the same and just the right amount of different." The spirit of LittleMonsters.com infuses Gaga's entire relationship with her fans. Her music itself speaks clearly to these themes, born this way, having become something of a national anthem for the monsters. And so does her dialogue with monsters via her huge social media streams, where she regularly shares the art and ideas of her fans. She is a champion of their creativity. She describes herself and is referred to as Mama Monster, more matriarch than superstar. In doing all this, Gaga has over many years not just built a more die-hard fan base for when her albums drop, she has developed a broad constituency she is able to steer at key moments. In 2010, Gaga, escorted by 4 gay service members, 2 men and 2 women, presented at the MTV Video Music Awards, asking viewers to call their senators to get them to repeal the Don't Ask, Don't Tell bill. She held rallies in Portland, Maine, asking fans to call their senators, and tweeted Senator Harry Reid, then the Senate Majority Leader, to push the vote. With Gaga's call to action, senators' lines were flooded with so many phone calls that the switchboard was overloaded. Her campaign forced the Senate to update their phone system to better handle incoming citizen calls. As one headline put it, "U.S. Senate getting Gaga-compliant phone system." It is no coincidence that these 3 examples of new power leadership are women. In her analysis of the research addressing differences in the leadership styles of men and women, Alice H. Eagley observes that female leaders, on the average, are more democratic and participative than their male counterparts, men more than women adopt a top-down, command-and-control style. Eagley's findings speak to a much earlier insight by Mary Parker Follett, a pioneering management thinker. In her 1918 book, The New State, she sketched out a fresh view of how to lead that played down power over in favour of power with, a jointly developed power, a coactive, not a coercive power. This idea presages an important strand in contemporary feminist thinking that emphasises more participatory and equitable approaches to power. Today, enabled by a proliferation of technologies that supercharge collaboration, Follett's vision feels more attainable and more necessary than ever. Of the three new power leadership skills on display in these stories, perhaps the most difficult to master is shaping values and behaviours beyond the bounds of one's direct control. For Gaga, that meant kindness, diversity, and tolerance. Comstock championed a new culture of experimentation. Pooh fostered pride, dignity, and the willingness to confront inequality, rather than accept it as inevitable. Not everyone succeeds. Next, we'll turn to a contrast between two approaches to leadership on a difficult issue, race. One approach was very new power, the other very old, and they led to very different outcomes. Hashtag race together versus hashtag Black Lives Matter. Leadership in a time of hashtags. It began with one voice, read the opening lines of Starbucks press advisory announcing its Race Together campaign. It continued, as racially charged tragedies unfolded in communities across the country, the chairman and CEO of Starbucks didn't remain a silent bystander. Howard Schultz voiced his concerns with partners, employees, in the company's Seattle headquarters and started a discussion about race in America. To explain his vision for Race Together, Schultz posted a 6-minute video featuring himself talking over footage of racially diverse Starbucks employees participating in company forums about the initiative. The last few weeks I felt a burden of personal responsibility, not about the company, but what is going on in America, he declared. He then encouraged his baristas to write the hashtag, #RaceTogether, on customers' coffee cups and engage them in conversation about race in America. Schultz, a white baby boomer billionaire, was rallying his army of young low-wage workers, a substantial percentage of whom are not white, to make time during the 45 seconds or so that the milk was being steamed for a double chai fat-free soy latte to stage what will become America's most awkward teach-in. The reaction was swift and harsh. As at Igioma Olu pointed out, being a barista is hard enough. Having to talk hashtag race together with a woman in Lululemon pants while pouring pumpkin spice is just cruel. Or as at Rain of April put it, not sure what at Starbucks was thinking. I don't have time to explain 400 years of oppression to you and still make my train. The backlash was such that Starbucks head communications honcho ran for cover and temporarily shut down his Twitter handle. The story took over the Starbucks annual meeting, held just after the campaign was launched, overshadowing the company's impressive results. A couple of weeks later, Starbucks ended the campaign as planned, but it was clear that it had not gone at all as planned. Schultz raised an important subject that deserved national attention at a time when it would have been safer just to launch another warm and fuzzy campaign on recycling. But his initiative is a fascinating case of how even a leader with good intentions could have gotten the three S's, signalling, structuring, and shaping, so wrong. We made a tactical mistake, so what? Schultz told Fast Company about Race Together. We're moving forward. But this was more than a tactical mistake. First, the campaign, beginning with its 6-minute video, was all about Howard. He was presented as the hero leader, bravely raising an issue other CEOs wouldn't touch. He then partnered with another white billionaire, Larry Kramer, the publisher of USA Today, to place an op-ed with a picture of Schultz at the top to promote the campaign. This approach crowded out the people who might have helped him make the initiative work. By taking up so much space himself, there was no room left for others to occupy. Race Together seemed hasty and ill thought out, but this was no whimsical move. Schultz had tested and developed his thinking with a fair amount of consultation. He had been encouraged by the enthusiasm he had seen at a range of open forums among his corporate staff. Yet for all this engagement, the flaws in his plan had not surfaced. This is one of the big challenges of the listening tour ever popular among CEOs. There aren't a lot of employees, even relatively senior ones, with the gumption to say, "Great to meet you, boss, love your passion, but you're dead wrong on this one." And his frontline workers, who were blindsided by the campaign, were left wondering how on earth this had happened in the first place. If we're going to have a discussion about race, how ethnically diverse was the group of people who decided this was wise, one barista asked at the time on Instagram. Simply consulting your base is a rudimentary application of new power and not likely to generate meaningful feedback. Truly structuring for participation requires more. Paradoxically, in the absence of this, an old power strategy might have helped. Holding closed, online, or confidential forums can create a pathway for brutally honest feedback. It is easy to mock hashtag race together, and many did. But there was something to the idea. Schultz understood that coffee chains, like Starbucks, have become a de facto 21st century community center, albeit one that favors gentrified neighborhoods. Starbucks stores around the country might have been used, perhaps alongside other local spaces in poorer areas, to host local events moderated by organizations with experience facilitating difficult conversations about race. You can imagine, too, how Schultz might have recruited his diverse army of baristas, not to watch his video and write his slogan on paper cups, but to build something of their own. Hashtag Race Together started with just one voice. It would finish that way, too. Schultz's attempt to exercise leadership on race issues did not come out of nowhere. Race Together emerged in the context of a national movement led by activists who had very little in common with Schultz and who have adopted a radically different leadership approach. Three black women started hashtag Black Lives Matter. One is Nigerian-American, two are queer. Complicate the narrative, because all hashtag Black Lives Matter, declared the official at Black Lives Matter Twitter account several months after activists and others around the United States had taken up the slogan. Black Lives Matter is a meme that became a movement and has shifted the conversation about race in the United States. The activism it inspired has forced changes to policing practices, boosted black turnout in some elections, shaped legislation, booted out police chiefs, and drawn renewed political and cultural attention to the systemic injustices black Americans face. It began with a Facebook post. In 2013, after George Zimmerman was acquitted of the killing of the black teenager Trayvon Martin, activist and organizer Alicia Garza wrote a powerful post that ended with the refrain, "Our lives matter, black lives matter." Garza's friend Patrice Cullors turned this into the hashtag that became a global trend and an umbrella for fighting injustice, hashtag Black Lives Matter. Opal Tometi started to set up social media accounts to broaden their campaign. It soon began to catch on, and people started to offer their help in building the movement. Cultural workers, artists, designers, and techies all offered their talents. The founders' tactics became a model example of the crowd-building approach we discussed in Chapter 4. Garza, Cullors, and Tometi set about, in Garza's words, creating the infrastructure for this movement project, moving the hashtag from social media to the streets. They began to mobilize online and on calls, connecting organizers around the country with the goal of creating the space for the celebration and humanization of black lives. Their response to the killing of Michael Brown by police in Ferguson, Missouri, took the movement to the next level. The three women, working as always in partnership with others, quickly organized the Black Lives Matter Freedom Ride, where activists from around the country piled into buses and rode to Ferguson to support local organizing efforts and the community there. This iconic moment inspired many more. 3 months later, in December 2014, a Black Lives Matter banner stretched across the crowd at the Millions March NYC. This 50,000-strong march was initiated by 23-year-old Sinead Nichols and 19-year-old Umara Elliott, who had never organized a protest before. From its start in a Facebook post, Black Lives Matter exploded across the country, grabbing national headlines and growing into a cluster of organizations, local chapters, and loose-knit swarms.